listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Citing the power of literature to shift societal views and norms, from Charles Dickens to Charlotte Bronte, renowned author Elena Poniatowska holds the same hope for Jennifer Clement's Prayers for the Stolen. This brave work of storytelling is harrowing, enchanting, and grips the reader with its lyricism through a haunting narrative about the young women in rural Guerrero who are stolen by the narcos to never return. We are pulled into the surreal, where beauty is dangerous, where scorpions are less threatening than the human animals who haunt and sting. From the moment I began reading this story, I couldn't put it down. Its transportive quality, its sentences, short yet poignant, the metaphors and underlying truths upon which the story was built, is all-consuming. Clement's talent lies in her ability to craft prose with a poet's sensibility, to inhabit many worlds and bring life to them through her discerning, intuitive style, one that exemplifies her unique position as someone who has listened deeply to the real-life stories of the women and girls who inspired this work. It is our deep honor to host Jennifer Clement, who visits us from Mexico, a place where her roots run deep and her relationship to Guerrero began at the young age of 3. And I hope she might share more of her family's fascinating history with us. Her novel, Prayers for the Stolen, was awarded the National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship for Literature and has appeared internationally on many Best Book of the Year lists. Clement is also a poet, and her work has been translated into 24 languages. She served as the president of PEN Mexico during a time when the country became one of the most dangerous places in the world to practice journalism. As we delve into the fictional world of Prayers for the Stolen, I invite us all to pause and to consider saying our own prayer for the stolen, the real life stolen, in particular, the 43 young students from the same state of Guerrero as Clement's main character, Lady Di. The 43 from Ayotzinapa. May they and the countless others never be forgotten. In conversation with our author tonight is local writer Magdalena Edwards. Her essays and lyrical experiments have appeared recently in The Millions, The Paris Review Daily, and Los Angeles Review of Books, where she's also an editor. She has studied 20th century poet translators from the Americas and occasionally translates poetry and prose from Spanish and Portuguese. Together, let's welcome Jennifer Clement and Magdalena Edwards to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
So thank you, Maureen. I'm really, it's an honor to be here. This is such a famous program, and for any writer to be invited here is something a writer always dreams of. So thank you to Louise for creating this, and thank you, Magdalena, so much for being here with me tonight. So I guess I'm going to start just reading a little piece. The novel really came to be when I first heard that the women in Guerrero, the mothers, were digging holes in the field and hiding their daughters in these holes when they would see these SUVs coming, looking for girls to steal. And just 2 weeks ago, the latest report is that for trafficking of girls, Mexico is second after Thailand. So this will be just this little section, and then we'll go to the questions and answers. The hole was too small. My father had dug it up when I was 6 years old. I had to lie down on my side with my knees at my chest, like skeletal remains of ancient burials I'd seen on television. I could see slivers of light peer in on me through the thatch of leaves. I heard the sound of a motor approach. The ground around me trembled as the SUV drove up to our small house and stopped in the clearing, right above the hole and above me. My small space became dark as I lay in the shadow of the vehicle. Through the leaves, I could see the SUV's underbelly, a web of tubes and metal. Above me, the motor was turned off. I could hear the sound of the handbrake as it was cranked into place. The car door opened on the driver's side. One brown cowboy boot with a high but square and manly heel stepped out of the car. Those boots didn't belong to this land. No one wore boots like that in this heat. As he stood with the car door open, he looked straight at my mother. From the hole, I could only see his boots and her red plastic flip-flops face each other. "Good day, mother," he said. The man's voice did not belong to this land. The boots and his voice were from the north of Mexico. "Is it always this hot here?" he asked. "How hot do you think it is?" My mother did not answer. "Ah, mother, put down that gun." The other car door opened. I could not swivel in my hole to try and look around, so I just listened. From the passenger side of the SUV, another man stepped out. "Do you want me to shoot her missing?" the second man asked. He coughed and wheezed after he spoke. He had an asthmatic voice from the desert, a voice of rattlesnakes and sandstorms. "Where's your daughter, huh?" the first man asked. "I don't have a daughter." "Ah, yes, you do. Don't lie to me, mother." I heard a bullet hit the SUV. The vehicle shook above me. I heard the brat-tat-tat explosion of machine gun fire, along with the sound of the bullets breaking up the adobe brick walls of our home. Then it stopped. The jungle swelled and contracted. Insects, reptiles, and birds stilled, and nothing rubbed against anything. The sky darkened. The machine gun had fired the wind out of the mountain. "We were your best hope, mother," the first man said. "I birthmarked the place, didn't I?" I heard the second man say through a shrill wheeze that became a whistle. The two men got back in the car and slammed the doors shut. The driver turned the key and started the motor. When he placed his boot on the accelerator above me, my hole was filled with the vehicle's exhaust fumes. I opened my mouth and breathed in the noxious smoke. The car backed up and drove off down the path. I breathed deeply. I took in the poison as if it were the smell of a flower or fruit. My mother made me spend the next 2 hours in that hole. "You're not coming out until I hear a bird sing," she said. It was almost dark when she pulled the fronds off the hole and helped me out. Our little house was sprayed with dozens of bullets. Even the papaya tree had bullet wounds, and sweet sap oozed from the holes in that soft bark. "Just look at that," my mother said. I turned. She was pointing at the hole with her finger. I peered in and saw 4 albino shell scorpions there, the deadliest kind. "Those scorpions showed you more mercy than any human being ever will," my mother said. She took off one of her flip-flops and killed all 4 in beating blows. "Mercy is not a two-way street," she said.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's amazing how visual the language is and the suspense. I wanted to ask you first about your relationship to Mexico, because you were born in the U.S., mm-hmm. you grew up in Mexico City, spent a lot of time in Guerrero and in Acapulco in particular, but also studied literature in New York City and in Paris, and you're a woman of the world. How would you describe your relationship to Mexico?
Well, I feel that Mexico is my country, even if I don't look like it, I should feel that way. It is my country. And the truth is that it was perfect for me to set the book in Guerrero because it is a part of Mexico that I know very, very well. And I used to go there a lot as a child. I even remember, you know, where the 43 were missing. I mean, we used to go to Iguala all the time because it was the only place in all of Mexico that had a Dairy Queen. Ah. So we could go have ice cream there on the way to Acapulco, and we would take the old road, which is now filled with heroin laboratories. And when you've read about the decapitations and people being hung from bridges, and that's all the old road to Acapulco.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned these details that are harrowing, terrifying, tragic. At the same time, the book is also filled with moments of human connection, joy, humor, history. Can you say something about that?
Well, I mean, the book, there was a lot of research into writing this book. It took, you know, 10 or 11 years of writing the research. But even the research, I was always going into these worlds thinking of poetry and looking for the poetic experience. So I was always trying to find how, you know, the divine does exist with the profane and how beauty does exist with ugliness.
Right.
And so I was always looking for that contrast. And so I think that's what you're feeling. So that would take me to poetry, and it would take me to humor and hopefully to enchantment also.
Right, yeah. Right. So the title, The Prayers for the Stolen, I wanted to ask about that. Who were the stolen? I mean, I know obviously these girls who are hiding in the holes, they can be stolen, they want to escape that, but are there others who are stolen? And what are the prayers, and do they have an effect? Do they have a power?
Well, there's a lot of stealing in the book. The mother is somebody who's constantly stealing. She works as a cleaning lady, and she's always stealing stuff. I'm very interested in the weapons of the weak and how people without power exercise power. And so that's something that's always coming up in the book too. So the stealing is a way to exercise power if you're powerless.
Right.
So there's that side to it. And then the prayers, well, the mother is actually quite superstitious. So she is always feeling that she shouldn't ask for what she wants because then she's definitely not going to get it. So she's always fighting against that superstition that she has.
Right. Mm-hmm. I also had a feeling that the prayers in the book have a relationship somehow, a parallel maybe to song and to the power of song. And there's this idea in the book that truths come out through popular songs. There are things you don't tell, you can't talk about them, but you will hear about them eventually in these ballads. And there's the one ballad for Juan Rey Ramos, that says, even dead, he's the most powerful man alive. So I wanted to ask you about the power of song and popular song in the book.
Well, it's in the book, and the song holds the key to the book, actually. She understands what's happened thanks to a song. Mm-hmm. But songs are very important. They're called corridos, and they're a very important part of narco culture, and they're ballads where they sing things that have happened and exploits that have occurred. And actually, it's interesting, a lot of musicians have been killed in Mexico. I mean, that's a whole other huge story. But they have been musicians who have told a story, sung a song they should not have sung.
Right.
Or they have, betrayed somebody and sung the song at the wrong party. And sometimes they even have been kidnapped to go play there's music at a party, you know. So the musicians get into a lot of trouble. But if you're interested in this, I mean, it's a huge subject. It's fascinating. And I wrote that song.
Oh.
So, yeah, well, it's my corrido. of my book.
Are you going to sing it for us?
But I love that first line. I thought it was like, I got it right. Even dead, he's the most powerful man alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what it's like.
That's a great segue to my next question, which is about the years you spent interviewing, researching this book, listening to women and their mm-hmm. stories. And I wanted to know, well, first of all, just to highlight, you know, I think you spoke to many kinds of women, some imprisoned, some who were wives and girlfriends of narcotraficantes. And mm-hmm. and did you ever feel in this whole process that you, like one of these musicians, was in a dangerous situation, that you were in a dangerous situation?
Well, the research began. I didn't really know what I was going to do, but I knew that I wanted to write about how the violence was affecting women, because actually it's been a story that's been sort of very male-driven, even within narco literature. It's very much about men. And I have to say, even the 43, they are 43 men. I'm just in Veracruz in the last, you know, 6 years, we have 6,000 girls missing. Mm. So, you know, it is, even that is a story that, you know, obviously is terrible, but at the same time, it is a story about men. Young men.
Right.
So I was interested to understand what was happening to the women. And so I didn't really know at first where I was going. And I started out by interviewing the women of drug traffickers. And that ended up being very important for the book, because I didn't know it at the time, but I bring a girl that has been trafficked back home. I don't actually know any woman who's been trafficked or girl and brought home. But because I had interviewed all these women, I knew what their worlds were like. And they told me about the ranches and everything that went on there. So I was able to describe so well that world that in Proceso magazine, which would be like the U.S. equivalent of something like Time magazine or something, that whole section of my novel was printed there like news.
Oh.
So they knew that it was so accurate right. about what these ranches were like. But these women told me. So the first part was that, and a lot of those women that are hidden all over Mexico, there's a whole sort of network. And it was actually Lidia Cacho, who I'm sure all of you have read her books and know her, who sort of took me into that world where there's a lot of women who are hidden because of domestic violence, but I was particularly looking for the women of narcos.
Right.
And one of the questions I always would ask them is, well, what did he buy you? What did you get, you know?
Right.
And of course, it was always like thinking of Hannah Arendt all the time, because it was just so banal, you know, a leather jacket. And you think, how many people died for a leather jacket? So that was sort of the beginning. And then I had to stop because Calderon came to the presidency and started that big war on drugs. And so it became much too dangerous because everything became chaotic and nobody knew what was going on. And then I became president of PEN Mexico, and I had to address the killing of journalists. And actually, that of the whole time of the research, that was probably the most dangerous time and made me really reflect that actually journalists are really dangerous people, whereas grieving mothers and little girls are not.
Right.
So it was sort of the most dangerous part of that work. And then the third part was going to Guerrero and speaking to all kinds of women in Guerrero. And then the fourth part was in the Mexico City jail for women. And then a bit the fifth part, it was very important for me to have a Central American character, because I don't think you can tell the story of Mexico without today talking about the vertical frontier that goes from Central America to the United States. And we have two frontiers, really. And for me, it was very important that she be from Guatemala, because of, you know, the story of Guatemala is so terrible and so unknown, really, in a way.
Right.
But, so...
Were you always planning to make this a novel, or was it nonfiction at one point?
Yeah, I wrote a lot of nonfiction pieces at the beginning and about narco culture and things like that, but basically I am a novelist and a poet, so I knew that it would probably go that way, but it wasn't until I heard about the holes mm-hmm. that I knew, oh, and then I knew that what I was going to write. I don't think I slept for sort of 3 nights just imagining these little girls in these, on one hand, like a rabbit warren,
Right.
And on another hand, sort of like a little living grave, in a way.
Right. Do you want to read for us the passage where Paula comes
from? Oh, sure. Okay, so as I said, Paula, I mean, in the novel, a girl comes back. Her name is Paula, and so she comes back, and she's obviously very traumatized, and her mother feeds her with a baby bottle, and she has cigarette burns on her arm, and she has explained that the women burn themselves with cigarettes so that if they're found dead, people will know that they were a stolen girl. So the mother asks, the main character meets her in the jungle, takes her back home, and has this little conversation with the mother. So she goes, "She told me about the cigarette burns. Did she tell you that she did it to herself? Did she tell you that all the women who have been robbed do this to themselves?" I nodded. "Do you believe her?" Concha asked. "I don't believe it at all. I can't even imagine burning myself. That's impossible." "Yes, I believe it." At that moment, Paula appeared behind her mother. She was like a white, vaporous creature. She held a baby bottle in one hand. She was naked. In the dark, under a river of moonlight, I could see the nipples of her breasts, the black hair between her legs, and the constellation of cigarette burns all over her body. I could see the cigarette burn stars that made up Orion and Taurus. Even her feet were covered in the round burns. Paula had walked through the Milky Way, and every star had burned her body.
And it's amazing that she comes back, because we almost are waiting throughout the book for her to be taken. She's the most beautiful girl in this group of friends. She's the most beautiful girl
in Mexico.
In Mexico, more beautiful than Jennifer Lopez. Mm-hmm. It's repeated several times in the book. And so she's taken away, and her mother becomes desperate. But she comes back. And you said that you hadn't actually met anyone who had come back. So how did you...
Because of these interviews that I did with the women of drug traffickers, I was able to know where she went.
Right, right. So. But to navigate that moment, that return, and sort of the implications of that for everybody, I thought that was so interesting, right? Because when she left, her absence was a part of their lives. Mm-hmm. And then she came home, and they had to contend with this other version of her. Right, yeah. Almost like a baby. So it's, I think that doubling of a person, I thought was so.
And crazy. It was important for me to be able to say where she'd been.
Right.
You know, because there are all these ranches in the north of Mexico, and it's, you know, that have been built with an amount of money that we can't even comprehend, and so they're full of, you know, tigers and lions and mausoleums that have bathrooms. I mean, just insane places.
Right, and the fact that she actually tells Lady Di what she saw.
What she saw.
And that's a very precise moment. It doesn't happen right away. It's almost, in the scene between the two of them, Lady Di is just saying, "You can tell me, keep going." And we get all of these details. Yeah. There's so many powerful themes in the book. The double lives, the sisterhood, the dangers of beauty, the thirst for revenge, those left behind. And one theme that I was really drawn to is this double-edged nature of being invisible. Because in a way, if you're invisible, you're powerless. At the same time, there are characters in this book who can make themselves invisible, and they're so powerful. You know, if you can disappear people without anyone knowing you were there, for example. I don't know if was that something that you were thinking about, the power... of invisibility?
I don't know. I don't know if I really was thinking. I mean, I agree that there are a lot of sub-themes.
Yeah.
There's sub-themes. I mean, technology is a sub-theme.
Right.
And this whole idea of that we all have now, which is television knowledge.
I love the television knowledge. I have a question about that. Can you tell us about that? Because that's so interesting.
Well, you know, it's amazing to think how new television really is.
Right.
And
So I wonder, you know, especially when you go to places that are sort of, you know, where maybe, you know, people are still living, you know, in houses with dirt floors, but yet they have a fantastic television and a parabolic antenna. And so they're able to watch all this information, but without a context of education.
Right.
And this is happening all over the world, you know, and then the dependence on cell phones, which is also, you can be in the most primitive place in the world and there's a cell phone, and then that Mike deals drugs to the spring breakers through Facebook. I mean, it's just like there's this whole sub thing about technology. And then I think another big theme in the book is herbicides and insecticides and pesticides.
Right.
The terrible thing that's going on in Mexico, which is, and in Colombia, they just decreed that they can't do it anymore. But, you know, you have this terrible amorality where you have, you know, countries in the European Union producing these herbicides and they're not allowed to be used in Europe, but yet they're used all over Mexico.
Right.
And of course, because of the corruption, the herbicides aren't even dropped on the crops. They're dropped wherever, you know.
And it falls on the...
And it falls on the girls.
Girls,
and,
right.
And then I think another big theme is the pain of living without men.
Yes.
It's very much, I think, I hope, a book that speaks to... I mean, at one point the mother says, living without men is like sleeping without dreams.
Right.
So it's very much a book. It's, you know, people would think maybe that, oh, it's a book about trafficking, so it must be a book about hating men. It's not at all a book about hating men. It's a book about loving men and how it feels to be with the lack of men, either because they've gone to the United States to work and have created a second family in the United States, or because they've been killed, or because they've gone to another part of the country to look for jobs, or they're simply not protecting their women. And so I think it's very much a book about what it is to be without men.
Right. I was really drawn to the relationship between the girls and how, you know, you might think that this book would be just one sad, terrible scene after another, but they are doing what young people do. You know, they're hanging out, they're telling jokes, they're telling stories. They have a new teacher every year who comes from the city, and they have, you know, a relationship with that teacher, and they're going through puberty. I mean, they're doing normal stuff as well. So I thought that that was very powerful, how you were able to show that normal, everyday life as well as this very specific, terrible context. We were talking before about how the book actually was 100 pages longer, and you had to take a lot of things out. You had to let go of scenes. Is there anything that you had to take out that you wish could still be in the book, or that you would want to share?
Well, the third part of the book takes place in the Mexico City jail, the women's jail, and I could write like 3 books about that jail.
Okay.
I mean, so I don't know that I will, but yeah, there were lots of things about the jail that I would have loved to have been able to keep in, but it didn't serve the book to keep them in, so yeah.
I also wanted to ask you about the title of the book in Spanish, because it's been translated into Spanish and it's being read very enthusiastically, and the title is different. In Spanish, it's Lady D, so they took the main character's name. What do you think that does for the book, and do you feel that the book has a different life in Spanish, that it functions differently, or comes across differently?
Well, it's not just the edition in Spanish. In many countries, the titles change a bit. This is very common because it sounds weird or whatever. And actually, in Spanish, I worked very much on the translation, so I feel that it's fantastic in Spanish. I mean, my credit's not there, but I worked on it. And the problem with the title had more to do with the Spanish audience in Spain, that because of it's not like Mexico, it has its own other issues, and it was problematic to have a title with prayers in it. Mm-hmm. Because the editor in Spain felt, you know, that it might sound like a Catholic book or a religious book, and so So it was sort of a midnight decision to call the book Le Vivi.
Can you tell us the story of why she was named that by her mother?
Well, I can't really tell it because I'll give it away, the story, but it's not what you expect why she's called that. But it is a kind of tribute to the princess, to Lady Diana, who, as far as I'm concerned, and there's a lot of like fairy tale themes in the book. So for me, the real princess was kind of an anti-Cinderella. We saw her get married, and then it turned, and we thought she was Cinderella. Mm-hmm. We all thought that. But then it turned out that he didn't actually love her. And then it turned out that he abandoned her. And then they stripped her of her title. And then they took away her security. And then she dies in a car accident. So she's very much sort of an anti-Cinderella for me.
Right. tragedy upon tragedy.
Yeah.
What are you reading now? What are you enjoying?
What am I reading right now?
Reading? Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm actually reading Keats.
Oh.
His letters and his poems, yeah.
I've had a chance to read some of your poetry, and I really enjoyed it. And I wanted to read a small excerpt from one of your poems. It's called Making Love in Spanish. When I make love to you in English, the objects in the room have no sex, and I only hear our voices. But when I make love to you in Spanish, the chairs, those little girls, chatter, and our shoes want to step with adoration on the body of light, lamplight, that falls across the floor. And the poem goes on. You have to read it. It's amazing. I wanted to ask you about writing in Spanish versus English. And you talked about how you were really involved in the translation into Spanish. So do you feel that that's different for you, each language?
Well, my sister and I talk about this a lot, and what it is to be bilingual, because we are bilingual. So, and what, you know, so you make the choice to write it in English, but if you're bilingual, for example, just in reference to that poem, I mean, even if you're writing in English, you know that everything has a gender.
Right.
So it's like a shadow that's behind your English at all times. Or it even maybe is coming through in a mysterious way that you're unaware of. So it's, to be bilingual is complex. And my sister and I have even thought about writing about this because it's very interesting. But certainly one huge thing would be the gender thing. That's why I had so much fun writing that poem, because if you make love in Spanish, well, everything becomes animated, and everything's making love with everything, you know? So that doesn't happen in English.
And yet you still read Keats. So when you were writing the book in English, did you hear the voices of the women that you had interviewed in Spanish? Was that like a shadow?
Yes.
Yes.
It's hard to explain.
Yeah. And
but it's interesting. It's hard for me to see it, but in some of the criticism, literary criticism of the book, it's been that it's this very interesting English.
Mm-hmm.
That's an English that feels like that's in the cadence or something is very Mexican Spanish about it. And I think it comes from being the bilingual thing.
Right. So when you first heard Lady Di's voice in your head, you know, and you knew, okay, I have my main character, I'm going to start writing. Was that in Spanish or in English?
I don't really know. It's sort of both. I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Do you see this book connecting to your other books about Mexico, your other novels?
One of them, yeah. I have a book called A True Story Based on Lies, which is about the mistreatment of servants. And so that's very connected in a way to this book because it's about women, it's about being powerless. Yeah.
And do you have any plans to write another book about these characters? Because when it ends, I don't want to give away the end, but it feels very natural that like now we're going to go to the next book. There's
no, there won't be a sequel, but no? there will be what I call a diptych.
Okay.
Or like a mirror.
Okay. Yeah.
That will come.
Set somewhere else. Yes. You don't want
to. Yeah, but well, I don't want to say too much.
It's a secret. It's good to have secrets.
I can tell you one thing. It's going to be about guns.
Oh, okay.
That I can tell you. Yeah.
Okay. Do you find a connection between this book and your book, Widow Basquiat, which is set in New York? It's a nonfiction.
It's a memoir.
Yeah. Because I read them one after the other, and in a way, they speak to each other for me.
Well, I think they're both books. I think I've written enough books now. I didn't know this when I did it, but now I can see it, that I'm always writing about the unprotected. So certainly all those people, I mean, it's funny because Patti Smith's book about that time, you know, Just Kids. So, and I love it that we were just kids, but we were also all of us runaways. Like the only person that was from there was Jean-Michel Basquiat. He was from Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. But everybody else, I mean, Madonna came from Michigan. I came from Mexico. Keith Haring came, I think, from Ohio. I mean, everybody was coming from, Suzanne came from Canada. I mean, and New York City was so dangerous. I mean, it was a problem for me to go to New York City. I mean, my parents were really against it. And I think everybody's parents sort of felt that way. So yes, I mean, we became sort of family to each other, and we took care of each other, and we were all sort of a little unprotected. And certainly, you know, the story of Jean-Michel Basquiat is a very sad story.
Yeah. And the story of drugs, too, somehow.
Well, and also the story of AIDS. I mean, I always think that it really, that sort of moment, that incredible moment, which was also the fantastic sort of, you know, explosion of the gay movement. And you know, it was a place where gay people felt very comfortable going to New York or going to San Francisco. And then to suddenly have AIDS. So I always sort of feel that, at least for me, that everything sort of came to a halt with AIDS. Mm. You know, it used to be that you could, you know, kiss a stranger or make love to a stranger, not anymore.
Right. Well, I think that it would be really good to invite all of you to ask questions. I have one final question, and after that, there's going to be microphones circulating, so if any of you guys have a question, don't be shy. Make sure that it is a question with a question mark and not just a comment. So, in terms of the reception of the book in Mexico today, How do you feel that this book has been received? I mean, I would assume it feels part of this very urgent conversation about what's happening. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it's been amazing. It's been incredibly well received. And the thing is, for me, the book has always been like a requiem for Mexico. And I think a lot of us feel just so heartbroken about everything that's happening. So what people have said to me a lot in Mexico, what they love about the book, is that it's a loving book. Because so much of, at least like narco literature and all of that, it tends to be very sexual and very violent. And whereas the treatment in my book is not that. You know, it has a very sort of love. I mean, I guess it has to do with the fact that it's very important for me to treat my characters with dignity. And so I'm always aware of that.
You know? Yeah. It does feel, in a way, it does feel to me hopeful in that you have all of these young people, and they're persisting in their lives, and they're growing up, and they're going through things, and they're kids, and they're also exposed to a lot of very difficult things. But there's humor, there's enchantment, there's seduction. It's loving. I think that's a great way to describe it. So who has a question for us? The microphones are going to go around. Great.
Welcome to Los Angeles. Thanks for being with us. As a multicultural person, I'm quite interested in your insights into Mexico. In general, it seems like a wonderful time to be a criminal in Mexico. And I would appreciate your comments on the nature of the impunity that we read about all the time. And is there hope? Or do you see hope in the future? And as a resident, I understand you're a resident of Mexico City. Is Mexico, excuse me, is Mexico City truly a little Switzerland, kind of an island of tranquility? And if so, what accounts for that? Why is Mexico City somehow protected and different from the rest of Mexico?
Well, the first part of your question is one of the gravest problems in Mexico is the impunity. I mean, we have 103 journalists killed and nobody's in jail for having killed a journalist. And 25 disappeared who I don't think are going to appear. So yes, the laws are not working, but I don't think, and that is Mexico's fault and Mexico's problem. But I also have to say that there's no way that Mexico can solve its problem without the United States also solving its problem. It's not a just Mexico problem. So there's so much really amoral business going on. I mean, the latest, one recent study is that if guns stopped going to Mexico, 47% of American gun dealers would be out of business. I mean, you know. And the consuming of drugs is in the United States. So it's a complex problem that Mexico can't solve alone. And then Mexico City is not a Switzerland in Mexico. Mexico City is really, Mexico City is territorially the largest city in the world, and it's lots of villages and towns that are joined by roads. So there are villages and towns that are very, very dangerous, where terrible crimes have committed. I don't know if any of you knew about the whole thing about the Heaven Disco, where these young kids were taken out and murdered. I mean, that happened, you know, two blocks from the Angel statue. So you can't just roam free in Mexico City. You have to know where you're going.
I was very affected by the section of the book that took place in the jail. You were talking about the research that you did, and when you mentioned that you try to treat all of your characters with dignity, I was very impressed with the dignity that you showed to those women. Could you talk a little bit about the research that you did in the jails?
Oh, that really moves me that you say that, because I loved the women in the jail, and I loved my time there, and I love them. And one sort of incredible gift of this book has been the amount of letters that I get from women in prison saying, thank you for writing such a loving portrayal of the jail, because, and I got one letter from a prison in Virginia, where there was like a prison book club, saying, that they hated that Orange is the New Black, that they just detested that series. And I tried to watch it, and I also detested it, and because it's such a cliche. And so I guess, yeah, I mean, I felt a lot of compassion for them, and certainly no judgment at all, you know.
I hope this doesn't seem ignorant. I hope this doesn't seem ignorant, but the question I have is, these young women being basically kidnapped, are they being kidnapped because they're then sex slaves, or what is being done with them?
Yeah, they're being kidnapped to be sex slaves. You know, they might be sometimes the girlfriend, or, well, girlfriend is the wrong word, the companion, I don't know what you would, the slave, I guess, is the slave of the drug trafficker who stole her for a while before he sells her. The trafficking of people all over the world is a huge problem. And one of the things that has become so clear, because this book has been published all over the world, and to my complete surprise, and it's just such a mystery, but what I have, you know, seen as I've been traveling around with the book is that the stealing of girls is a problem all over the world. And the fact that women don't have status and value is a problem all over the world. And even when I've been to countries like Finland or Sweden, you know, illegal immigrant women do not live under the law of the country. They're not protected like a Swedish woman is protected. So the African women or the women coming from Russia, they're all being trafficked because they're not protected by those laws. So it's a problem everywhere. And it doesn't take these criminals too long to figure out that you can sell a bag of drugs once, but you can sell a girl many times, and many times in one day. So it's a huge problem.
As someone that's binational, bilingual, and bicultural, would you, first question is, what can we do? I mean, there's all of this going on, and I'm heartbroken like you are. I mean, I've lived both in Mexico and the U.S. How can we help?
Well, I think we have to have a radical inclusion of men in the discussion. I mean, everywhere I go, it's women talking to women, and we all agree. So that's what I think has to happen on a worldwide level.
I think we're paying the price of slavery in this country. And we'll continue probably for a long time. And I'm wondering whether Mexico and probably other Latin American countries are paying the price of the conquistadores, that the sins that they were committed and the aftermath. And what's your opinion?
Yeah, I say that in here. I don't know if I can find it, though. There's a section where she meets Luna, who's from Guatemala, in the jail, and she says, you are a Mayan, I can't say it exactly how it's written, but she says, you are a Mayan Indian from Guatemala, and I am a Mexican Indian with black slave blood. Because in Guerrero, there's black slave blood. It's mixed. We're just two girls. We're just two people out of a history book. You can tear us out of a history book, roll us up in a ball, and throw us in the trash. So I address that. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Due to the emotional aspects of the stories of the women and all the things that they suffered, and then you're having interviewed so many in the jails and various places, how do you or did you as a writer not become overwhelmed at times due to the tremendous human suffering that you heard about? How did you keep your own emotions in check?
Well, I think it has to do with, I hope this answers the question, but obviously I'm not the only person who does this kind of work. Mostly journalists do this kind of work, more than novelists. And among us, though, because we know each other, we never ask ourselves, were you afraid? I mean, that's a question that we never ask, because we all know who do this, that our indignation is greater than our fear. And so how do you deal with it? I think it's because the indignation is so great and you have to do something with that.
Thank you. Hi. When I was reading your book, it reminded me of Beloved. And the idea of living with ghosts and living with spirits. And I came away from it feeling like the land itself was haunted by not just the spirits of the girls who were stolen, but by just ideas of what the land should have been, dreams broken, et cetera, et cetera. And I just wondered if that was intentional or whether that was just a result of your poetry and the poetry that's in you.
I think it's probably the poetry, I think. I don't recall sort of thinking I wanted to do that. I think it just organically happened, yeah. And also because since I grew up there and I know that place so well and I know those people so well, I mean, For example, Jacaranda, who you know, I knew that Mexico where women would walk the street and buy braids, you know, and that the braids were either kept in drawers and bags or they would cut them off and sell them. You know, when people would buy hair, I remember that. You know, so those are like ghostly things from my memory.
I'd love to know a little bit more about your work, your former work as president of PEN Mexico and some of the things that transpired under your tenure, and also your choice to write this book as fiction, despite it being grounded in truths. Has it truly shielded you, or are you still somewhat in the camp of the other truth tellers who do work in nonfiction?
Well, I mean, to me, it's not. I actually get asked this many times. You know, why don't you write it as nonfiction? And the truth is, I mean, I really believe in the power of literature. And I mean, I think if you think of the history of the novel, which is actually quite a modern form, it has always been used as a kind of denouncement of social issues, and has changed the world. I mean, Oliver Twist changed. Child labor laws. I mean, certainly in England, the property laws for women were helped to be changed by Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte, and Victor Hugo's books helped change conditions for the poor in France, or the miners, you know, conditions described by Zola. I mean, so yes, I think that novels are very powerful. So it's not a contradiction for me to write it as a novel. And actually, for me, I mean, these characters really feel alive to me. And also, when I read books, I realized I was a great success as a mother when my daughter had spent, we all know who Elizabeth Bennet is, right? Pride and Prejudice. So she had spent a weekend with some unfortunate relatives, and she wrote me an email, and she said, "Oh, I felt just like Elizabeth Bennet." And I thought, oh, I have succeeded as a mother. Elizabeth Bennet is more real to us than a real person. So, and my time at Penn. The time at Penn was tremendous. And the one thing I can say that was really important that came out of that was PEN Mexico, as well as Amnesty International and CPJ and the Knight Foundation and Article 19, we did manage to get a law changed in Mexico, which was a huge thing. So it used to be that if you killed a journalist, it was a state crime. Now it's a federal crime. So that was a big thing that we managed to do. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Hi, I wanted to ask you about the Basquiat's widow. It's a weird to talk into this. and in general, there's this kind of binary to your titles that, you know, like I mean, you just talked about the history of true based on the truths based on lies, and until I read your Basquiat story, didn't know that he also had a widow or had female lovers. So I'm kind of interested in that as a strategy, but also to know a little bit more about the book, Basquiat's Widow.
Well, it's a memoir. It's not a novel,
mm-hmm.
although it's full of poetry. Basically, I had a lot of trouble figuring out the form of how to write it. And so I'd written it many times, and it didn't work because it's actually such a little, small period of time.
Yeah.
So it couldn't have a sweep, you know. And then it just hit me that I had to write it like a silent movie. So it's written like a silent movie with short scenes, and I had a lot of fun thinking of the titles. She is this girl, you know, scene. You know, so the whole thing is, it's like a silent movie. And then there's the play of the voices, because there's her voice, which I wrote, but is based on her voice, her stories,
And also she's a great friend, so I can hear her inside of me. So I was able to also have this play between a very lyrical third-person narrative and a more sort of down-to-earth voice. And sometimes they contradict each other.
Yeah, I mean, that's been really interesting. And I thought maybe it was based on actual notes you found, and that was one section, and then the other section was more...
No, it's more playful than that, yeah.
And then in terms of your titles, is there a kind of poetry to the binary or the oppositional kind of...
I don't know. Titles are so hard. Sometimes they come to you so easily, and sometimes they're so hard to find. I don't know. It's sort of mysterious, I guess. I mean, Widow Basquiat, that was a nickname that René Ricard gave Suzanne. So that sort of seemed logical to me. Yeah.
Jennifer, I have one follow-up to that, which would be for Widow Basquiat, did your friend Suzanne read the final draft and sort of approve it before the book was published? And to follow that question, have the women who you've interviewed for this book, have they read the book, and what do they think? Or did they read it before it was published?
Well, Suzanne read it before it was published and only asked me to take one story out. And I did. And the only people that have read this book are the women in the jail.
Okay.
And they love it. Okay. It's like their book. So, yeah.
A quick question. If you can read in both languages equally as well, what would you recommend? Or is there... I know we kind of talked about how you wrote this book and how you think in English and Spanish, but I'm just curious.
Which version would you recommend to read?
Yeah, English.
I think if it depends on what you're most comfortable in. I think the Spanish version is wonderful. I think it works very well. I think it's perfect, actually.
A perfect translation. It's rare.
But I translated it with a couple of other people. It was a team effort. Yeah.
I have a little small question. The book seems very interesting. Did you think about having somebody turn it into a movie? So... You know,
oh, I'm thinking about it all the time.
Oh, my God. That would be
I just need somebody else to think about it.
Yeah. That would be very interesting.
Yeah, it's actually has been bought by the BBC in the UK for a radio play and by several theater companies, but not the movie, not yet. No. Even on Broadway. Yeah.
Any more questions? Okay, so I want to invite everybody to the lobby where Jennifer will be signing copies of her book, and I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight, and I want to welcome you back for the next event here at Aloud. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.